Good morning and welcome to the local government division. It is Wednesday, January 20th, 2021. And obviously this is going to be a very exciting day for our country. I will call the meeting to order and would our LA like to take the roll, please.
Good morning. Representative Mason.
I am here.
Representative Elkins.
Present.
Representative Guam.
Present.
Representative Berg.
Present.
Representative Bolden.
Present.
Representative Hewitt.
Present.
Representative Meckland.
President.
Representative Olson.
Present.
Representative Joaquin.
Present.
Everyone is present.
Thank you. We should do the minutes. Representative Elkins, have you read the minutes?
I move that we approve the minutes.
Okay. Is there any additions or corrections? Okay. We'll move to approval of the minutes as written. All those in favor say aye.
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 Those, same sign. The minutes are approved as written. Thank you so much. We're going to start today's meeting with the introductions of the staff for this committee. And I'll start with Peter Strohmeyer, who is our committee administrator. Peter, it's yours.
Morning, members. My name is Peter Strohmeyer. I'm the committee administrator. I've been at the Minnesota House of Representatives for a little over 14 years now. And my very, very first committee that I was assigned to was the local government committee. So looking forward to the work of the committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Next is the RLA, Josh Kilgard.
I've been at the House for 2 years and was with Jobs and Veteran Affairs prior to this, so it's good to be with local government.
Okay. Next, Chelsea Griffin from House Research.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Chelsea Griffin, House Research. I just started with House Research at the end of October to replace Deb Dyson, who retired in December. I'm very much looking forward to working with all of you over the course of the biennium.
Thank you. Next, Joe Marble, GOP Research.
I've been with the House since 2007, and I'm looking forward to working with this committee as the GOP Research, and look forward to working with you.
Thank you so much. And last but not least, Eamon Gallagher.
Thank you, Chair and members. My name is Eamon Gallagher. I'm the DFL researcher, and I've been with the caucus for 2 years. I'm looking forward to working with the committee. Thank you.
Thank you. And for our agenda, we're going to go with Elizabeth Wethel, who was held over from our last meeting. If you would like to introduce yourself and proceed, and thank you for being agreeable to come back this week.
No problem. Thank you. You can all hear me, right?
I can.
Great. Thank you, Chair Mason and the rest of the committee. I'm very excited to be here. I am here on behalf of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, which is a nonprofit advocacy group representing communities throughout Minnesota outside the 7-county metro area. I am one of a number of people who work with the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, and there is a separate handout you should have received that has a list of everybody who works, you know, either full-time or part-time on these issues. If you have any questions about any of our issue areas for the coalition, I strongly encourage you to reach out to them. There is a PowerPoint. It's very brief that I'll walk through. There was also, I think it was in last week's agenda, but not this week's, there was a handout sort of outlining a little bit more in detail who we are, as well as our priorities for the legislative session. If you want copies of those, I can also forward those to you. But, you know, our basic mission is to develop viable, strong communities for businesses and families throughout Greater Minnesota through strong economic growth and good local government. We support a number of things to make that happen, including property taxes, good land use planning, sensible environmental regulation, a balanced transportation system, and effective economic development tools. Those are, that mission really is reflected in the areas we work on. And those are sort of the five principal areas that you will see us in at the legislature. So that would be LGA, which is really our biggest thing that we work on at the Capitals, LGA and property tax relief. Economic development, which right now really has a focus on areas such as childcare, broadband and housing, things like that, that really impact Greater Minnesota. Annexation and land use, which I'm responsible for. Transportation, environment and energy, which I also am responsible for. And then we do labor and employment. That's more advising. We don't really do a lot of lobbying on labor at the Capitol. But you can see we have this map. We're 102 cities. It's actually been growing. I joined the coalition a little over a decade ago, and I think we were like, I don't know, around 70-ish, 80-ish. And it really has grown. We have cities of all sizes, all the way up to Waro and Rosen, down to La Crescent in one corner, Laverne in the other. So it's really a good cross-section of our cities. This year, kind of the really big things we'll be working on are contained in, like I said, that handout that we gave out last week. But I won't walk through all of it, but again, local government aid, making sure that that gets paid on time and in full, really is our number one priority this year. We will be working with other city organizations to make sure that sort of concerns around the pandemic are addressed. Obviously, that's sort of we don't add that as our permanent mission because we're hoping that goes away by the end of this year. Environment, we'll be working on, again, pushing for more money for wastewater and drinking water through the PFA. We think that's really important. And we're also going to be working on a municipal strategy to try and keep per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances out of Minnesota's waters. Those are PFAS. Addressing child care shortage in Minnesota, tackling the housing challenges in Greater Minnesota, tackling street issues. Those are really the main things that we'll be working on. You'll notice that there was one thing I did not mention, and that is annexation and land use. We think this is a really important issue, but I'll be honest, it is not something we are pushing anything on, and that is the issue area that you would be most likely to see us on. Annexation is an area where we actually work very closely with the League. Craig Johnson is the person over there who's responsible for it. He and I, normally if it was a Capitol year, you'd be seeing the two of us walk around the Capitol talking about that and PFAS together. It's really important to us because a lot of, cities that have room for growth are located in Greater Minnesota. And we really do have a lot of communities out there who, have robust economies, who, want to grow in smart ways that really sort of protect the environment, that protect good land use. And so that's something that we will be, we will work on if called upon. Now, I don't know how familiar all of you are with annexation. I know a few of you are returning to the committee, but it really is that process by which Minnesota's land use goals are achieved. I know that the Minnesota Association of Townships, mentioned it last week, and they highlighted some of the same things that I would highlight, that annexation policy in Minnesota recognizes that sound urban development and preservation of agricultural land and open spaces are really essential to economic growth throughout the state. And city government is best for intensely developed land. Townships are best for ag, open space, and rural area. One of the areas that I would disagree with on with the townships that said last week was that we do think that there is overall a fair process in Minnesota. There are things I think that both of us would like to change, but one of the things I think any of you who've been through this a couple sessions have seen that it is really unfortunately that if you make one change that may benefit one side, it really sort of harms the other. So it's really important when dealing with annexation law to make sure that when we make changes, they're mutually acceptable to both of them. Because if we don't have agreement, you basically have winners and losers in a zero-sum game. Just two other things I'd like to mention about annexation. There are several different methods of annexation. One isn't better than the other. They all fit, different circumstances, but it really is an important part of how, our cities and our regions sort of look towards the future and make sure that, as populations or business grows, that they're getting sewer, they're getting the infrastructure they need, and that we're also protecting our open space, which, I think we all can agree is really great for Minnesota. In terms of other issues that may come before you on local government, we do tend to let the League of Minnesota take the lead. But we, again, if something really hits Greater Minnesota in a special way, we will step forward and we are always there. We really do have a good partnership with the League and with the other city organizations. And even the counties and the townships on other issues where, stuff that affects local governments, we will pull together and work on things. So if you have questions, again, on anything that does affect cities in Greater Minnesota, please do reach out to me or any of my colleagues. And, we're there to help and answer questions. So that's all I have.
Thank you so much. Are there any questions for the testifier? I see Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Chair, and to the testifier. I'm kind of curious, and this is just maybe a long shot here, but this last year has been terrible for us, and how we've all responded to COVID has been something mm-hmm. we've never done before. Mm-hmm. And I've seen that the cities also know that the economic impact on that COVID has caused many of our businesses and our cities is really tough. Mm-hmm. This is not the last super bug we have seen. Mm-hmm. We may see more. There's some all around the world. Mm-hmm. How can we develop a plan with the League that works together with the cities and the state? Because I know you lean a lot on the state for direction as we lean a lot on the federal government. But I think if we have a unified plan together in a situation that comes along down the line, we may be able to be a little bit more proactive. What are your thoughts? And has the league started this discussion?
Ms. Weffel.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Hewitt. That is an interesting question, and I'll be honest, the things I work on tend to be annexation and then wastewater, but I can tell you, for example, that a lot of our wastewater facilities have been actively engaged, in research with like the University of Minnesota Duluth Medical School in terms of right now we're focused on how do we track COVID through wastewater, which I know sounds a little gross, but actually is a leading indicator of where outbreaks are going to be. So I think some of what we're doing right now and, we're building that foundation, and that research is being done both for the short term because we do obviously want to know where the outbreaks are going to be, but it's also helping us sort of learn how do we address things like pandemics in the future and how do we, work with, use our city resources to do that. So there are pockets, like I said, that we are working on that with an eye towards the future. And I think you do correctly assess a problem that we are going to have going forward, and that I hope, even at a national level, we're gonna put back a pandemic planning unit into the CDC. In terms of what we will be doing, bigger picture, there's a couple things I can think of, but I also want to defer sort of the folks who are smarter in that area than me. There is one thing I guess I'll point out. We used to have this as part of our, if you were to look on the CGMC's website, you'll see that we actually have detailed policies for each area. And for the annexation and land use area, for years, we had a policy that said we want to bring back the state planning agency, which some of you may remember if you go way back, because you've got the Metropolitan Council, you don't have an equivalent for Greater Minnesota. So there used to be the state planning agency, which took some of those functions. And so, I don't know if that's, if that's the sort of approach or if it's done at sort of the coordinating done at like MDH or whatnot. But I guess I would agree with you. That is something we need to be thinking about in the long term. Our cities, especially, mid to large size ones, do sort of a lot of comprehensive planning, and it might be sort of looking forward that that's where they need to put it there. But I guess saying anything more than that, I I would be making it up. I could come up with lots of great ideas, but I'm going to confine my expertise to wastewater and land use.
And Mr. Chair, yeah, thank you very much. That got us, and I just want the discussion to start. Okay. So thank you, and thank you, Mr. Chair, for the time.
And maybe along this line, I'd like to mention that for people who don't go back that far, there used to be a state planning agency, and the fact that we don't have one to me still boggles my mind. It used to be a department at one point of about 35 people. And basically all we have left now is our demographer and one or two other people. And it's done in different ways, but I know a number of years ago, Senator Clark and I had a bill where we were trying to bring back some state guidelines based on some of the others. The attempts have been done many times, but right now we really don't have any specific state guidelines as we're making our laws, which to me is kind of, it's really hard to put together something if you don't know what your end goals are. But again, thank you for bringing that up. Are there any other, Representative Berg, and then Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifier, when you were talking about some of the issues that your office works on in terms of, or your organization, in terms of childcare, housing, broadband, even wastewater and drinking water, those are all issues that we see our communities of color struggle with across the state. And I'm wondering, especially given COVID and we're, you know, those inequities are right in front of us. No longer can we deny them or pretend that we don't see them. I'm wondering if there is an intentional mechanism where you're baking equity into the way that you're approaching these subjects and the solutions for your community.
Ms. Weffel.
Thank you. And thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Berg. You know, equity is an issue I think that our communities have been starting to struggle with, you know, over the last several years. And I think it wasn't just this past year that showed that. I do think, honestly, when you get the results of the census, it's going to surprise a lot of people. Probably more people outside of Greater Minnesota will be surprised about what they see than I think if you were to talk to the mayors, you know, particularly like in our southwest corner where we have cities that, you know, I think some of the cities that have the highest portion of people of color are actually, you know, in pockets of Greater Minnesota. Right now, I don't know that, you know, it is, you know, we've done numerous, you know, we've done things through the years, you know, bringing in folks to talk to our cities about, you know, how to deal with that. Right now, our policies are, I don't want to say they're at a higher level, but they are aimed at helping anyone who would be disadvantaged. Like if for wastewater, we are really focused on making sure that everyone has, you know, is able to afford clean and affordable, you know, wastewater and sewer services. And that is done, you know, through financing, trying to recognize that a lot of our communities, we have people who fall below income levels and whatnot. So that's, you know, sort of we've been the, you know, our approach has been that we want, you know, we recognize that our cities are made up of, you know, a lot of different folks, and we've been trying to address that sort of through rising all boats. But I would say over the last couple of years, we've been trying to figure out more and more on how to do that. And I think that that is sort of using the equity frame specifically as that language is going to be an ongoing discussion.
Follow up, Representative Berg.
Thank you so much. And thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And well, a couple of years ago, I saw an issue with small towns and communities in Greater Minnesota where they had someone move in, open up a business, and property values bumped up in the downtown area, or in Rochester, speculation caused huge increases in the valuation of in the business district. And so I tried to start looking at how can we provide a mechanism where the city, can designate an area and then allow for a back-looking property valuation or some sort of a discount to a portion. So if a city wanted to have daycare providers and some small businesses that served a portion of the business activity that didn't have the cash flow to support the huge bump in property taxes, they could be delayed so that as long as they didn't sell, they had a lower property tax that they were paying. And if they sold, then there could be a five-year look back because they're gaining the valuation of what the property is. It's like farmers are rich if they sell their farm, but then they're no longer farmers. And then when COVID came, I thought, you know, a lot of businesses are having trouble. And this might also be a mechanism to, for a short period of time, assist in maintaining the character, so to speak, because I know a business had been around for over a century, but they had to close because they couldn't afford the increased valuation and the property tax. So it's a really difficult topic, but you know, if you know members of the committee and the testifier had some ideas, we could maybe come up with an approach that would allow small towns to maintain their character, which often is defined by that cafe or some special business that's in them, or large, you know, larger regional centers. You want growth, and you bring someone in, and now all the pre-existing businesses can't afford the fact that the property is now worth five times as much. But again, if they sell and see that valuation, then you no longer have that business. So it's just a reach out to the testifier and other members of how we can be creative and allow some flexibility with the cities. Thank you.
Ms. Weffel, do you have a response?
I would just say thank you, and I will pass that along to our property tax team.
Okay, thank you. I am seeing no more hands raised. So again, thank you so very much for your time, and I know we'll be seeing you again. Thank you. Have a good day.
Thanks.
Next, all of you, I want to talk about the rules that were given to the committee. They're pretty standard. Are there any comments or questions on the rules that we can adopt for the committee? And I'm not seeing any hands. So, okay, well, we'll move on then. Our main speaker today will be the chair of the Metropolitan Council, Chair Zelli. And if you would introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony. Nice to have you here.
Very nice to be here, Chair Mason. Thank you so much. I share your excitement about the day. So I've worn my red, white, and blue shirt here just for the committee. And hello, everyone. I am here as chair of the Met Council, and I know there is a lot more expertise in this virtual room than what I have in my head. So bear with me as this, we do this overview. But I think there's some in this room where you might be new to understanding the role of Met Council as its own regional government. So I'm happy to be here and kind of give an overview. I have a PowerPoint, which I will try to share here in a minute. I do want to point out that I am joined here with a number of a few Met Council people. The Director of Community Development, Lisa Bajaras, is here, as is Terry Dressen, our Director of Communication. You all know probably Judge Shetton, our Director of Government Relations. And also Mary Bogie, who is our acting regional administrator, Meredith Vadis, who you also may know is our regional administrator, who almost a year ago came to me and said, I need to spend a couple of weeks to help implement testing centers that the governor's asked me to do. And I said, Meredith, this isn't going to be 2 weeks. And he said, no, it can't be past May. So clearly she is now still there and really doing an excellent job and now heading up a lot of the rollout of that vaccination. So we're being called to service. So I will see if I can share this screen. Can everybody see that?
I can.
Lovely. All righty. I'll keep going. You know, as I say, Metro Council is a creation of the legislature, and it really goes back over 50 years, established in 1967 as a regional planning organization, but also the way to provide essential services that individual communities, cities can't really do efficiently on their own. And so it's kind of unique in the country. There are other metropolitan councils, but nothing quite as robust as what we have here in the Twin Cities. It's actually kind of won many awards, and I'm not sure if we could ever establish something like this now, but I think it is widely appreciated. Sometimes there's a love-hate relationship, but I think everybody agrees this is providing really important work for the region. Essentially, we're there to establish regional growth policies, long-range plans for transportation, aviation, water resources, regional parks, housing, and water supply. So we're often associated with MetTransit, but we are really much more. We actually do operate transit. We do transportation planning, but we also are the operator of wastewater collection and treatment, and also the largest HRA in affordable housing. We're governance is always a big issue, and I will kind of go through a brief overview. We have a 17-member council that governs the organization. We represent seven counties, Anoka, Carver, Dakota, Hennepin, Ramsey, Scott, and Washington. And each of the council members are appointed by the governor, and I will get into the nomination process here in a minute, counties and cities do participate through the nomination process. And of course, the Senate confirms all the appointments. You can see how spread out these districts are. 16 separate districts. The chair is a kind of an at-large member. Idea is to have pretty broad representation, but every member of the council kind of has at least the idea of kind of thinking regionally for issues that benefit everyone. The nominating process, as I mentioned, does make recommendations after public interviews that the governor considers when and always has followed the recommendations from the nominating committees. This is the committee structure. Each council member, except for the chair, serves on at least two council committees. There are four main committees, those meetings are public. We encourage the public to attend, and we've continued the attendance process during our emergency orders when we've been having virtual meetings. We've had opportunities for occasional comments and testimony, but more often now, this past 9 months, we've had more email comments to respond to. The council also is not shown, but has a number of advisory committees that considers very specific regional issues, including transportation, land use, other planning processes. So those advisory committees is an opportunity for local elected officials, representatives of of partnering organizations as well as members of the public kind of participate as we develop our policies for full consideration. I could show an organizational chart that has just, hundreds of boxes, but this is the main kind of organization. We actually have close to 5,000 employees. We consider the main operating entities where we operate wastewater, we operate transit. But you can see we're in three different divisions, each having a planning and an operating role. Community development has both our housing, our parks work, our planning for the comprehensive planning process. Environmental services, this is really where all our water work is done, primarily managing the large wastewater system. And then transportation, obviously Metro Transit, but as well as our transit planning. I'm going to go through each one and kind of give you a set of more information than you probably would care to have. But when you consider, you look at this slide, you realize every one of our functions at Met Council has been set up by the legislature by statute. So we really are following guidance, and we follow, as I say, we follow the law, but we also really are guided in very specific areas that we engage most of our time on. And at times there are those who would love us to go into other areas, but we actually do not have the legislative authority to do. We're not an economic development agency, as an example. But you can see here, we follow a lot of the Land Planning Act. So it's an interesting conversation, Chair Mason, when you say we don't have a state planning office, and I think that is a loss, but we do a lot of that function for the Metro Seven County region. And it really is essential when you consider how Met Council was established. It was to try to align ourselves as one metropolitan region. And I think that has been really helpful. We have as many as 180 or more separate municipalities and townships just in that seven county area. So it's not just there to align against the will of a township. It actually is a benefit to coordinate and to actually operate those things that individual townships or cities can't do by themselves. And as I said, this goes beyond just housing and transportation. We are so blessed to have such a robust park system in this state and in this region. And a lot of that is coordinated and helped funded by Met Council. So I think this slide really shows graphically the kind of 10-year planning process where you start with every 10-year census, which clearly we are just wrapping up. So we are at this particular point at the very end and at the very beginning of our land planning process that is very robust, both from a staff perspective, but also through the outreach, stakeholders, advisory groups, and of course the council themselves are engaged in both visioning long-term aspirations, but also getting and working with individual communities to assist, then ultimately approve individual city comprehensive plans. And I'm really pleased to say we are nearly have completed this last 10-year cycle, and many communities came in right in December on December 23rd, we were approving a host of cities with their comprehensive plans, in part because then they are now eligible to be part of our livable community grants. And I think this kind of shows both the vision and the details of a planning process. We are just now beginning. In fact, tonight at a council committee meeting, we'll be talking about the larger visions and goals for this next 10-year cycle of planning. And again, this is not top down. This is more bottom up but it's an iterative process, and I think it's been one that has really been helpful for creating a consistency and compatibility for communities that are side by side. Back to parks. When you, as I mentioned, we have a wonderful number of parks in the region. We think of them as individual cities or counties that have parks, but many of them have a regional function, and that's where Met Council plays a really, really important role. We are authorized to develop a parks plan, but we also approve and review each individual parks master plans for consistency. We help prepare a capital improvement program that allows both state and some of our own funds to help do really important capital improvements in all these parks. We issue council bonds as a way to match state general obligation bonds that may come to a particular project. So we actually are there to help augment some of the state funds that you see and hear about. We are actually the pass-through agency that provides funding for regional parks from both the legacy funds, but also from any other state funds. So you'll hear about parks in the legislature, and a lot of that in the metro area comes through Met Council. But unlike the DNR and other kind of greater Minnesota park systems, or the DNR, which actually owns land, Met Council is not operating a park agency. We work with these 10 partners. And as you can see, there's several that have actual cities, as we know, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Bloomington have their own really robust award-winning parks, but and also, of course, Three Rivers, which is mostly Hennepin County, but a little bit of Scott County. But we are, they refer to as implementing agencies, but we work closely with these parks to help coordinate their planning, funding for their regional kind of use. And when you think about some of the parks in St. Paul and Minneapolis, you know, they are, in Minneapolis's case, a separate jurisdiction from the city and its own taxing authority, or St. Paul, which is part of the city, but they still both all provide such a regional resource that there are people who are coming in from the suburbs to Theodore Worth Park for cross-country skiing, or and likewise, people in the city go out to Three Rivers Park. So this is great to have not one against the other, but it helps provide some coordination that we all are part of one a regional system. On to our Livable Communities Act programs. As I mentioned, this has been an incredibly important and robust program. Since I believe it was 1995, you know, it's been hundreds of millions of dollars in grants that have really been helpful. These grants go to cities and counties and their development authorities to support a number of efforts through the Livable Communities Program, but it's affordable housing, it's a particular program to help clean up polluted sites for redevelopment. We also are kind of a vision for helping build out pedestrian-friendly and transit-oriented developments. And, you know, we can point to any number of projects around the metro area that had a very catalytic grant that helped make the difference to help get the project going. And it seems like every other day you'll see an article. There's one yesterday about a project in Edina for affordable housing that came about in part with a Metro Council Livable Cities grant. Just the issue, of course, about the tax basis. This actually is funded through our own property taxes. The Metro Council is a very small property tax that it levies across the region. We have a very small authority. And I was looked at my property tax statement very carefully this last year, and I saw the Metropolitan Council was actually the smallest in many lines. So it's not individually severe, but it does add up and it has made a difference in number of activities. As I mentioned, we operate the state's largest housing redevelopment authority. So this is more kind of operations. We actually help a number of low-income families, and we help distribute federal housing Section 8 vouchers. And I would just kind of say in a number of ways, you'd think we'd operate these different divisions separately, but we've had a great partnership. We've learned working with Metro Transit and Metro Transit Police. I have to put a little shout out to the homeless action team within Metro Transit Police. That have known and found those that are unsheltered, that have been spending a lot of times on our trains, that we actually are able to transition some of those known folks into their own housing. And we use that, our own kind of housing authority and our voucher system, able to do that. So we've been trying to kind of think of ourselves as one agency involved with livability and housing and scarcity of affordable housing and the crisis, not just from the pandemic, but just from affordability generally, is one that we see as one of our main issues as we look ahead. Again, this is the region we serve for our housing authority. It's really all the metropolitan area, not covered by the individual city housing authorities. We certainly know Minneapolis, St. Paul, other communities have strong programs. But we certainly collaborate a lot with them. But there's many areas that don't have their own authority, so this really helps fill in many gaps. And then on to our water programs. This is an amazing system that is not as visible as our transit system because, of course, it's all underground. But this was, if you look back to Metropolitan Council coming together, was really a number of agencies, city efforts that kind of came together, and just like planning, but also operating the wastewater systems, having a metropolitan efficiency and point of view has really made a difference. And if this little chart shows, you know, how fortunate we are in this region to have not just Met Council, but the kind of the relationship we have with cities in the region. And as you see, we're one of the metropolitan areas that not all older cities have the benefit of a separated system. And if those who don't know, some foresight in the 80s really put in a big investment into creating a separate sewer system where the Metropolitan Council kind of has the 600 miles of what I refer to as the interstate of sewer pipes. Some of them are as wide as 14 feet. I mean, these are big pipes. But the city systems come right into the Met Council interceptors that I refer to. And of course, from the city, it comes right into people's homes. But the fact that the city stormwater pipes, which are not the wastewater, but goes into rivers and lakes, the fact that they're separated allows for us to manage consistent capacity, makes our system much more efficient. And when you think about the rainstorms, as we have more climate change, big surges of water in older cities overwhelm the sewer system. And you'll read about raw effluent going into the Potomac River because during a big rainstorm, DC can't handle it. So this is true in many old cities. So we were able to do it when we could afford to create this, frankly, well-capitalized system. We do it through fees. And over time, we built up a system that is much more less expensive, much more probably the best value one of the best values in the country. And I have spent the last 10 years whining about highway infrastructure and how it's undercapitalized. I actually have to say that this is a system that actually is up to speed. I mean, we keep investing every year. We have a robust capital investment program, and being able to have our bonding, or we have some of the highest rated bonds because of our balance sheets and our processes. And that's a kudos to Mary Bogey and others who have really made sure that we're being responsible. So this is an area I think we can feel really proud that we just need to stay on track and keep it going. Big issues of inflow and infiltration, that's where rainwater seeps into our system, both at the municipal and at the, frankly, at the private level. And that's something we're really concerned about, because we want to make sure that we don't have water seeping into a sewer system, because that makes it even harder to manage the supply. But when you think about the amount of wastewater around the region, and as our population grows, we manage and do a really tremendous job at not just restoring water, but in many cases improving water quality in our system. Most water is treated and put either back into a river or from its original source to the river. We have 8 water reclamation facilities, the most robust being the one in St. Paul, which covers most of the green area, the metro. Pretty amazing, 250 million gallons of water every day and serving 108 communities. The value of purity really is something that we're beginning to recognize is so critical for our competitiveness as a region going forward. The fact that we have water sources, but also that we are able to use water, in the case of Minneapolis, from the Mississippi. We use it and then we return it to the Mississippi in better and cleaner shape than when it first came in. So that's as a sustainable system as you could find. But we are, of course, always thinking about water in our planning and research role. We are not part of the supply operation, but we work with the municipalities primarily to develop policies and programs and sometimes just good data to help kind of plan for the kind of growth and development that we're experiencing, to ensure that water supplies are adequate and that they're not compromising our long-term sustainability. So we work with state partners, certainly the MPCA and DNR, but also with our local groups. They are a number of advisory committees. That's where all these are. The advisory committees involve elected officials as well as technical experts to make sure we have a thoughtful long-term approach. You know, the overall idea is to ensure that communities have the tools they need and the data and the policies they need to, again, make sure that their residents have an adequate supply of water in a cost-effective way. This is a big issue, I think, for environmentalists, for our region, for the whole state. You know, we think about the abundance of water we have in Minnesota. We know water is going to be the most critical, element when you think about regions around the country. But we don't have, because we've had so much, we don't have some of the discipline that, say, they have in Arizona, because we've hadn't had to worry about it. Well, so now we're getting really waking up to what waters are impacted, what areas we have been wasteful. And so this is, I think, a area that the Environmental Quality Board, certainly the DNR and the MPCA are very much involved in. And when you think about some of the issues we're focusing on, like PFAS and other elements that are in our groundwater, we know that we play a role in helping, again, mostly in a collaborative approach by assisting communities to know how they could react and plan. So everybody knows we play a role in transportation, and it has certainly been an exciting year for that, but we are continuing to operate a robust system, and we also act as a major planning organization for the region, including being the Metropolitan Planning Organization as a conduit for federal funds. We do long-range planning, but we also are involved in shorter-term actual allocation of funds to specific projects. When you think about just the transit services, clearly Metro Transit is the biggest in the probably 95% of the system. We certainly have many different modes, and you are all familiar with the regular bus system and the light rail systems. But one of the emerging and maybe future of our transit systems is the arterial bus rapid transit, like the A line and the C line that are operating with great success. Those are the lines that are going down Snelling and the A line from Minneapolis Blue Line connection up to Snelling and all the way to Rosedale. And the C line, which runs from North Minneapolis and on into and through the metro, we actually see as many as 10 to 12 more lines coming on within the next 10 years. We have funding, thanks to the legislature at this last bonding bill, to construct the B line and the D line. And the B line is operating from along Lake Street and Marshall all the way to St. Paul, and the D line is runs from North Minneapolis to the Mall of America on Chicago Avenue. These are really critical lines, and you think about where people are getting around. It has the look and feel of light rail, and yet they're on buses. They operate on streets. They provide a really great service that has become very popular. North Star, of course, commuter services, we also do. We have run Metro Mobility, Transit Link. These are for more demand response services in vans, and provide services where regular route service can't really either operate, or where there are those that are disabled and need special assistance. And Metro Mobility, I have to say, is a growing service. We have, as an aging population and more population, we have more calls, important calls on that service. That is one that is actually mandated both by state and federal government to ensure that we operate it. And so that's generally, we manage the process, but we contract that service with a number of different contractors who operate the vans. We also provide funding and planning for the suburban transit services. We provide both the capital funds and some federal funds that go to support those generally express services to downtowns. So our MPO function. Very important process that we work with a transportation advisory committee. It has really does much of that work, supported by some technical committees. We allocate as much as $200 million in every biennium to specific projects. It's not just transit, it's road and bridge, very innovative and a robust program. We coordinate a lot of that planning with other agencies as well, certainly MnDOT, but other also local governments. There's a lot of local government representation on those advisory boards, and those come to the Met Council for approval. But Met Council does not actually deliberate. It really approves or disapproves, but I've never heard of it disapproving the recommendations of those committee structures. There is robust regional solicitation to ensure we get a broad net of ideas, and we ensure that there's a lot of public engagement and process along the way. So that's kind of the quick tour of our program, and sorry to wax on, but it's I find actually whenever I look at some of those overviews, I learned something I didn't know, so I'm pleased to share it with you today.
Well, thank you. You cover a lot of territory, no doubt. I have, actually, there's more than one question I have, but the one I'm going to start out with, you had mentioned the Section 8, and we know housing is, we're having a crisis in affordable housing and low-income housing. And my thought is, at least in the area that I live in, it looks like it's getting really hard for people to use the Section 8. So if, you know, I don't want to catch you off guard, but can you, am I right in that? And where are people able to use Section 8 at this point?
Well, thank you, Chair, for the question. And I think we're always looking at ways to make it easier. I will say this as somebody who's comes in and out of government. There's a lot of bureaucracy to some of these programs that are so well-intended. You know, I'm actually going to, because I know Lisa's right here in the room, before I start making something up, there's Lisa. Maybe Lisa, you can kind of give more flesh on how we're evolving with implementing Section 8 voucher program.
If you would identify yourself and proceed, please.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Lisa Barajas. I'm the Community Development Director at the Metropolitan Council. The Metro HRA is a part of my division, and our households, yes, do have a hard time finding units that will accept their Section 8 vouchers as a form of payment. It's something that has been hard over the years, but it's definitely, especially in hot markets when the number of rental units available is diminished. Landlords have their selection of who they'd like to rent their units to, and oftentimes will select someone else that they can charge a higher rent to, because we do set rent limits and payment standards on what we're willing to pay. That is also based in the marketplace, but the landlords do have the ability to choose who they want to rent to, and some landlords are very clear that they don't want to rent to Section 8 users because they don't like the extra burden of having extra inspections and going through those processes. There are things that we have been doing, as the chair alluded to lighten the load for landlords and provide incentives to participate in our programs as well, making the inspection process easier, trying to spread it out as much as we can. Of course, we are within the federal guidelines for operating this program, so there's only so much flexibility that we have, and it's something that we often work with the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development on as well.
Thank you. Representative Elkins, is your question to this, or is it on another?
Something else. So if you want to keep going, that's fine, Madam Chair.
Are there any other questions of our current testifier? It looks like there are not. Thank you so very much.
Oh, so Chair, it wasn't about Section 8, but it is for the for Chair Zelli, though.
Oh, okay. Representative Elkins, proceed.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Zelli, for being here. So, having come here from 8 years on the Met Council, you know, I've had a close-up look at the work of the council, and just really wanted to reiterate a couple of things that Chair Zelli said. First, for us, and perhaps most importantly, the Met Council only does the things that it has been directed to do by the legislature. So for all of the talk that you will read in the press about the Met Council overreach, the Met Council only does those things that it is directed to do by the legislature in the statutes that Chair Zelli showed on the slide, where, you know, with the for each thing that the council does, where the legislation is authorized. the Livable Communities Program, which just about all of the vast majority, almost all of the cities and local governments in the region participate in, as something that I do think that we should look at, because several of the programs are severely underfunded. So the tax-based revitalization account, for example, which is used for brownfield cleanup, and we've got a lot of that to do around the region in the aftermath of the civil unrest last summer. The levy for that program has been capped at $5 million since 1995. At least we ought to be allowing the Met Council to increase its levies for programs like that to keep up with inflation. The local housing incentive account program, which supports affordable housing projects afforded by cities and counties, is also generally oversubscribed by a factor to 3 to 4 times. That grant program is very closely coordinated with Minnesota Housing's grant programs as well. And it doesn't really have a good dedicated funding source either. And I think that's something that that we need to look at as well. It's very popular. It actually helps direct affordable housing to cities that have relatively less affordable housing. And is broadly supported by the metro cities and the and its member cities. The last thing I wanted to mention, because we do usually play a role in this, is that because so many of our regional cities have such old infrastructure programs, the cities need help funding their improvement of their sewer pipes in order to prevent mitigate the inflow and infiltration problem that Chair Zelli mentioned. And for the last several legislatures, we have provided funding for cities to assist them to upgrade their pipes to prevent their stormwater from leaking into the sanitary sewer system and overwhelming that system during heavy rains. And I just want to call that out, because I think it's important that we continue to provide funding for that, the inflow and infiltration program again this year on our budget. So thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair Zelli.
Thank you. I see, I thought I saw Representative Quam. Did you put your hand down? It looks, okay. Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chairs, this question is for Chair Zelli as well. While I live in Sherburne County, which obviously you don't touch so much of, but you did slightly mention the North Star commuter rail. And it's been a big, obviously, thing of conversation up here for years, but more so after this onset of COVID. Can you answer what the current ridership is and what the current subsidy is based on the fallen numbers, if you would?
Chair Zelli.
Chair Mason and Representative, yes, as I mentioned, our longer kind of express commuter service throughout the Metro Transit system has been affected the most, and North Star is down 95% in its ridership. I don't have the exact figures of what that ridership is. But it is clearly some of the most affected, and because of it's a fairly expensive system to start with, it certainly has been one that we're scratching our heads. On the other hand, we look carefully and actually work with some of the counties that have a share of the funding of the operations of North Star. So we actually reduced the number of trips from 70 a week down to 20 per week. There is certainly that has been a cost savings, but there is an overall cost that is largely paying to the operator of the trains, which is BNSF. We actually even went so far as to look at if we were to suspend service entirely, what would that amount to? It is certainly overseen by the Federal Transit Administration, and they said if you could possibly suspend the service for a very interim period. But the cost of shutting a system down and then the cost of starting it back up really made it not financially better to actually suspend it entirely for a period of time. So we actually think that operating it at its limited scale now makes more sense. We are able to ensure that whatever funds we have, and that actually in part comes from some of the CARES Act emergency funding that helps mitigate that those costs a little, as it does all of our operations. And I would say that the benefit from NorthStar longer term is still, I think in the horizon. There has been a strong development plans and development that goes along transit corridors, and certainly NorthStar has had a positive effect in that regard. And MnDOT has just done this completed study about extending NorthStar to St. Cloud, and that's one that has gotten a lot of interest, particularly from the St. Cloud region. And it, in a way, maybe this is acting more like intercity train transportation, but it is still kind of a commuter service, so still MetTrans is involved in partnering with MnDOT to kind of look at that. I think that, idea of having different modes for different uses is really important for transit, and we only have this one commuter line. And I do think, personally, looking at stopping at Big Lake, which was a compromise when it was built, maybe that was not the best foresight, because the Big Lake is a great park and ride, but it's not a large anchor community like St. Cloud would be, to help kind of create those city pair kind of density to support the train. But we're operating it with its existing subsidy, but we've reduced the operating costs significantly just in the interim.
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chair Zelli, if you could provide me with some numbers. There was an article in the Star Tribune probably a month and a half ago that explained the numbers that I believe ridership was hovering around the 70 to 80,000 per month, and it's dropped down to about 1,000. I think what they found in their analysis was the subsidy is around $780 per person per way per day. If I recall, and this was a month and a half ago, I believe. But if you could do a little looking into those numbers and get those emailed to me, I'd greatly appreciate it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Chair and Representative, thank you. I absolutely will get back to you with the actual numbers. I will point out, when you look at subsidy per passenger, that it is true in the short term, although a lot of those costs are sunk costs that wouldn't change whether you operate it or not. So that's just kind of a period of time where you do have costs for a system that isn't being used, and that's totally true. But we'll share the numbers with you to show you kind of where things have been this past year.
Thank you. Next, Representative Quam, and then followed by Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm, considering your background and the great deal of activity of which the Met Council partakes in transportation and other similar activities, one of the big issues that we've seen in areas has been a decrease of availability of non-emergency medical transport. And also some of the people that are handicapped and other transport, where you don't have, it's not as easy with the large buses. I've been trying to get some discussions going on smaller, say like those shuttle bus size buses, having an app developed by the U of M, Met Council, and a couple of other entities, so that FedEx and other groups, they get a bunch of, hey, I'm here, 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 and here, I've got a pickup, or there's a drop off, and they have logistics software that allows for efficient, fast, and effective hitting all of those points. Is that something that the Met Council would be interested in cooperating and producing, so a person could have an app on the phone, say, I'm here, and this is the time frame to get from here, and I want to get there. And that way, the logistics would allow for a non-fixed route transit system. It would have in the software, if you're using electric vehicles, it would know when you would change out so one could charge and you pull the other one. And it would also feed in directly into autonomous transit in controlled zones. So the state of Minnesota would then be involved in some of those studies more readily. And that way we could deliver, quick and effective, because I've heard a lot of people complaining, oh, I live in Woodbury and I work in Minneapolis and it takes an hour and a half to get there, an hour and a half to get back. And if we do this microtransit clusters with fixed expresses, we might be able to more effectively do that. And the side effect is that app would be wonderful for greater Minnesota for non-emergency transit or medical transit and other aspects. So is that something that the Met Council, because you're trying to globally address the situation, would have some ideas on and be interested in?
Chair Zelli.
Chair, thank you. And Representative Quam, I would love to sit down over a cup of coffee and we could talk all afternoon about the future of mobility and transportation, because it is emerging in a number of incredibly creative and interesting ways. And there's no doubt that when you couple fixed route transportation with some of the transportation network providers like Lyft, Uber, as well as other kind of last mile solutions, whether it be a electric bike or some even clustered van operations, that we will be entering into a time when you truly don't need a car wherever you are in the metro area. How can you get around and do it efficiently so you don't have to take an hour and a half, you know, taking a bus to downtown and then switching and then taking another hour, you know. So you are certainly singing to something we're really interested in, but it is one that is one that's being planned. There's pilots that are being developed around the country. Certainly we have on the app side, a group within Metro Transit that is developing even more the next generation of trip planning. When you consider apps that isn't just showing from point A to point B within, say, Metro Transit, how do you actually link it with other modes and other uses so that that trip can be really a series of connections, including maybe what you're describing. The actual, when you start peeling it back, both Uber and Lyft, whether it's in their bike operations or their cars, are kind of a process of development. Even Uber does not make money. You know, it's there subsidized by its own private capital groups. So over time, you're actually going to kind of see what is the sustainable, effective way to fund this access, this mobility that we all want. And I think we are going to be we're certainly at the table. We work closely with other think tanks, including the Center for Transportation Studies, which is helping staff a shared mobility task force. There's other groups kind of looking at it. I think that the idea that there'll be one system, that there's one solution is probably not going to be the future. I think there is a role for what we call the fixed route network, which is interconnected, as I described, this arterial bus rapid transit that can kind of be much more of a local service every 10 minutes, providing the spine from which there's other offshoots that can connect to it, is kind of one way to think of it. Think of the transit and mobility as a interconnected pattern, and there are areas
in the metro where we're not served by express buses or our local service, and what you described is where are the options for those other lower density areas, and there should be options. And I think the idea of having a other kind of private providers provide connections is excellent, but there's a significant cost to that. So we have to make sure that we're allocating the scarce, you know, taxpayer resources in a way that we can benefit most. And when you think about transit planning now, we're thinking less about let's just measure how we can just make solve congestion and kind of we're thinking a lot about how do we provide access to jobs from those that most need that access. How do we provide the system that lets people get to where they need to go to live their lives? And that's about measuring with new data analysis, defining more. And again, this gets to what the University of Minnesota is working on, measuring those, how do you get people to where they need to go within a half an hour? And so it connects with land use, it connects to some of our planning functions. So now I'm going down a little rabbit hole and I apologize, but when you think about what you're describing as new technologies emerging the world, including apps, absolutely. But it is very much in process. We don't want to be ahead of our ski tips. We want to be, as I always say, we want to be in the leading edge, but not the bleeding edge. So, we're partners, but we don't have the funds to be what the private sector is doing in some of these areas. I'll stop there.
Follow up, Representative Plum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted us to get forward thinking. We always hear ridership, and forward thinking, I think we've got some solutions, and the Met Council is meant to facilitate regional solutions. And I've been trying 6 years. I'll give it a few more years, and hopefully we'll be able to see something, that isn't old technology. Thank you.
And Representative Chair and Representative Quam, just to follow up, thank you for your interest. We have a group within Metro Transit called Transit Next, which is really looking at the future, and we actually have our planners and our collaborations through Met Council Transportation Planning Division is also looking at us. So I welcome more conversation, and I absolutely think we have to be looking at the future. So thank you for raising the issue.
Thank you. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of follow-up items. So with respect to North Star, I mean, the subsidy per ride has always been relatively high compared to other services, but I need to observe that all, you know, throughout the region, the long-haul express services have been severely impacted by COVID. Most of the people who use the long-haul express services are what we would refer to as choice riders rather than need riders, and a lot of them, they're disproportionately people who are in professions where they're able to work from home. And so the rapid decline in ridership on North Star has been matched by similar declines on almost all of the region's long-haul bus services as well. And the other thing that I think might be worth looking into is I recall if we were to cancel the North Star service, I think we would have to pay the federal DOT back something like $350 million that they invested in the creation. And might be, you know, worth it when you get back to Representative Mecklen to, you know, have that figure as well. And then with respect to the line of questioning from Representative Quam, Southwest Transit, which serves Southwest Hennepin County and Carver County, has been experimenting with a medical appointment service as an extension of its Southwest Prime on-demand service. So they're actually experimenting with that now, and that might turn into a good model for other places as well. And then for some time, I know that Lyft has offered a program called Concierge, and it's used by hospitals around the country to schedule appointments for patients. And it works really well, and the hospitals that have done it have found that it pays for itself just in the savings from a reduction in missed appointments. So that's an option that's already about out there available to medical centers, at least in those cities which do have a measurable level of service from Lyft. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Chair Zelli, do you have a response or comments?
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Elkins. I clearly, when I looked in the room and I said there's other experts in the room, I wasn't kidding, and I know and I appreciate you for your knowledge, but also for your service at Met Council, and you've raised some great points. I will point out, just to follow up and add what you just said, the city of Columbus, Ohio, which won a major U.S. DOT grant for advancing the idea of being a smart city, and the transportation metric of success was the mortality rates of babies in a certain geographic area that was being underserved. And the reason that it shows that it's not about transportation metric, it's about actually getting the prenatal care and developing access to clinics through incorporating that Lyft connection as part of a medical appointment. And it has completely changed the actual mortality rate, which shows that transportation access and service really does change people's lives. And I think that these new kind of thinking more broadly and collaborating with some of these, like the Lyft program, is could be really transformative. And yes, thank you for pointing out Southwest's Prime piloting program. I think there's great opportunities, not just for new technology and such as advanced automated vehicles, but also how we stitch systems together. Starting with little pilots is a great idea, and they're doing it.
I did want to mention that some of us did have a chance to visit the St. Paul Water Facility last session. And obviously that's an incredibly impressive facility, both in size and scope, and just what a great job they're doing over there. The other thing I did want to mention, recently we did have a report on the Equity Committee. And you might want to say a few words about that. I think that gives a little bit more interest about how you are trying to proceed in the work that you're doing.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. There's no question of the four major goals for the council, equity, sustainability, housing and transportation access. Equity really needs to be an imperative for all the work we do, not just our grant planning and our transit planning, but also how we handle procurement, how we think about our own workforce. And we are guided in part through an equity advisory committee, which has been an intention for some time, but we're kind of getting it up and going to ensure that that this isn't, frankly, and to be candid, white guys like me deciding here's the solutions. This is a time for listening and for understanding and for considering in this post-George Floyd time that this is no longer something just to study, but we need action. And it is clearly probably the biggest issue that is discussed at the Met Council. We have a number of BIPOC members who are advancing not just their own point of view, but keeping all of us focused. And I think you'll be hearing more. I know that when we consider equity and Met Council's role, we actually are a leader, or I would say a co-leader, with other major institutions. We advanced and approved a regional economic framework in collaboration with the Greater MSP Partnership and the Center for Economic Inclusion this past year. A regional economic framework really lays out the regional ambitions for our metro area, and equity and an equity lens on all that activity, as part of advancing the idea of economic growth must be an inclusive economic growth, because we just can't sustain the vibrancy of this community and have the disparities that we've suffered all this time. And even though there's been many studies, the numbers haven't changed much in the past 10 years. When you think about the effects of COVID, they've certainly disproportionately affected people of color and indigenous populations, many in the metro area. So I actually think it's exciting. And when you consider that this isn't just a government activity, the work of the private sector, if you read the paper today, U.S. Bank has announced $1 million grant to the Center for Economic Inclusion to help create tables of trust and benchmarking. There's a private sector table, and I sit on the public sector table, where we will sit with other governments to hold each other accountable to some of the goals that we'll have to be more public about. And so I think this is an overall civic imperative that is a call to our time. And I think Met Council is is one of the leaders. We are certainly an important participant in advancing that work.
Thank you. I am not seeing any questions. We're almost out of time. Do you want to do a wrap-up, Chair Zeller?
Thank you, Chair. We've said a lot. We've covered a lot. So I appreciate your very specific questions, which are very smart and informed, and they lead, I think, to more conversations in the future. I just appreciate your support, your interest, and your collaboration as we work together toward what we all care about, which is Minnesota. And we live in an interesting time. As hard as 2020 has been, and the start of 2021 has been, we have to work through a lot. But I actually am very hopeful. I'm optimistic, and it's just a great honor to be a Minnesotan. It's a great honor to be part of this regional effort, because I think we're onto something. And I really appreciate the interest, support of all the members. The legislature has just been a key partner for Met Council. We're a separate regional government, but we're a creature of legislature. So you'll certainly see a lot of us, and we're certainly also here. If you have any questions, want additional conversation, we have experts way beyond me who can be helpful, and we look forward to doing that.
Thank you so much. And thank you all for being here today. Have a good day. The meeting is adjourned.